We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but he is like him." He kept saying, "I am the man." So they said to him, "Then how were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed and received my sight." And they said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I don't know." May God bless the reading of his word this morning. It's been my experience that there are certain environments that you walk into. And when you walk into this kind of environment, it just becomes aware very quickly that there are different kinds of people who receive different kinds of treatment. The airport is a great example in this respect. You walk in the airport, you start making your way down the hallway, and then you come to these mysterious doors behind which you don't exactly know what's there. You only know that it's very private and very elite because it has the word club associated with it. So you stand there and you stare and you wonder, what could they possibly have behind those doors that we don't have in the regular waiting areas here? And then you go and you step on the plane and you see some of those same differences too, for crying out loud. It's literally called classes of people. You have to walk through one class to get to another class and finally to another class. Different kinds of situations for different kinds of people. But then again, there are other environments that you walk into in which it becomes equally clear that there really aren't different kinds of people, that everybody is kind of the same when you get down to the core of who they are. The Department of Motor Vehicles comes to mind in a situation like this. Because there's no first class section at the DMV. There is a ticket counter, and it doesn't matter how much power or prestige or clout or money or whatever it is that you have, you take a number just like everybody else takes a number, and then you sit in the same area with everybody else and wait for your number to be called. It's equal footing at the Department of Motor Vehicles. And maybe that's why that is typically a place where there is also so much anger and ire. Because you want that. You know, you feel like there ought to be a way to circumvent this system. There ought to be some special line that if I know the password, I can get into that line instead of this line and somehow get a reserved kind of treatment. But it doesn't work like that. And then there's another environment in which all the things that tend to separate us from one another get blown apart. And that's the environment of the hospital waiting room. It's amazing that in the hospital waiting room, all kinds of things that tend to separate us suddenly disappear. Everybody sits in the same hard chairs. Everybody looks at the same television mounted in the corner with the same sign that says, "Do not change channel." Everybody feels some measure of anxiety or nervousness or hurt or trepidation about what's happening beyond those doors. And suddenly all of the stuff that tends to separate us is thrown out the window. You could say, in some ways, that the hospital waiting room is actually one of the places on earth that is closest to what the kingdom of God actually looks like. And you probably know what it feels like to sit in that waiting room with all the rest of us, to feel the same things that all the rest of us feel, to be treated in the same way that all the rest of us are treated, to have the same palpitations in your heart that the rest of us have. And I wonder if you could call that into your mind for the next few minutes as we approach John chapter 9. Because in John chapter 9, we're not just together on the dusty streets of Jerusalem watching Jesus perform yet another sign to reveal more about who he is. We're also, in a sense, in the hospital waiting room, encountering the reality of human suffering and observing the way that God in the flesh reacts to that kind of suffering. We're there with him, confronting these things together. And so with that in mind, we come to the text. And we remember, as we walk into John chapter 9, that as John chapter 8 closed, we just left a really dangerous kind of situation. Jesus had had all kinds of different conversations and delivered all different kinds of messages to all different kinds of people. And ultimately, at the end of John chapter 8, he made a pronouncement that was so controversial, that was so anger-inducing, that was so heretical in the minds of those who were listening, that at the end of John chapter 8, they actually picked up rocks with the intent of stoning him. It was a dangerous situation, a situation on the edge at the end of John chapter 8. And then Jesus moves from there into John chapter 9 and encounters this man along with his disciples. Now, this man that he encounters is evidently at least somewhat well known in the city of Jerusalem, because the disciples know a little something about him. Specifically, what they know is that this man who is blind is not blind because of some illness or malady that he suffered later in life. He's not blind because of some accident that he was in. They know that this man has always been blind. He was born that way, blind from birth. And so as they're walking along, the disciples take this opportunity to ask Jesus a question that they probably have wondered about for a really, really long time. And what better moment is there to ask Jesus this question to see if they can finally get an answer to it? The question that they ask was born from the line of thinking that was popular during that time, that you could draw a straight line from a particular act of sin to a particular instance of human suffering. So the disciples, with that in the back of their minds, say to Jesus, "Here is a man who is born blind. So the question is, who sinned here? Help us connect the dots. Was it this man or was it his parents? Because clearly somebody did, because the man is blind." Now you might be asking yourself, how could this man have sinned and it resulted in his blindness if he was blind from birth? And the reason behind that is also during this time, there was this strange kind of mix of reasoning that went under the banner of something called prenatal sinning. It was actually thought during this time that all of the souls of all humanity were sort of gathered up in one place at one time before they were actually born into human beings, and that those souls were actually good and bad and could perform sins or acts of righteousness. And so when the disciples say, "Was it this man who sinned?" they might have been thinking about this, even before he was born, that he committed some act of sin and it resulted in him being blind when he was sinned. Or if it wasn't him, then it must have been his parents. Again, because clearly somebody sinned because the man is born blind. Now Jesus answers their question, but at the same time he answers their question, he redirects it. So they ask Jesus this question, and Jesus in response says, "Neither one of them did. Nobody sinned that resulted in this man being blind. In fact, the reason that he's blind is so that the works of God might be displayed in him." And then after he gives this redirection, which is an answer, he expounds on this metaphor of daytime and nighttime. He takes the natural rhythm of life, which is that daytime is the time that you do work, nighttime is the time when you sleep, and he says, we're living in the daytime right now, and because it's daytime, there's work that we ought to be doing together. It's work that God has given us to do. So we have that work to do, but nighttime is coming. Jesus knows that the nighttime of the cross is not far away. So there's a limited period of time in which we got to get the work done that God has given us to get done, because daytime is not going to last forever. Soon it's going to be nighttime. And having said that, Jesus does something really, really strange. He goes to work doing the work that God has given him to do, and the mechanism that he uses to do this work is his own spit. He spits on the ground, and he makes some mud. Now, why would he spit on the ground and do that? I don't know. I don't know if anybody really knows. What we can say about that is this is not the only time that Jesus used his own saliva in order to heal somebody. If you turn over to Mark chapter 7, you see something similar happening. And we can also know that during that time, there was another line of thinking that human saliva actually had curative qualities to it. Pliny, the famous Roman collector of scientific information, even wrote that human saliva could protect against snake poisoning, cure epilepsy and leprous spots, and even relieve a crick in your neck. So it's possible what Jesus is doing here is he is using the mechanisms of the time in order to be the means of divine healing, maybe. Regardless, Jesus takes this paste that he makes out of his mud and spit, and he puts it on the man's eyes, and he tells him to go and wash it off in the pool of Siloam, and so the man does. He goes and washes it off, and he can see. And the change that happens in this man is so dramatic from that moment that people who previously knew him have trouble believing that it's the same person. They don't know who he is anymore. In fact, a sort of quasi-argument breaks out about whether this guy is actually the same guy. Is this really the same person that we used to see begging here every day? It can't be that person. Doesn't look or act or seem like him. That's not the same guy. He just looks a little bit like him. All the while, the man is saying, no, it's totally me. It's me. It's me. It's me. So they say to him, well, if it's you, then how do you explain the fact that you can see? And the response of the man is beautifully simple. He says, I did what Jesus told me to do, and now I can see. Now, if you read on in John chapter 9, which we'll do in the coming weeks, if you read on, you see that this sign that Jesus performs prompts a kind of inquest that happens. The Pharisees get involved. This guy gets hauled in front of them. His parents get hauled in front of them. He ends up getting excommunicated from the synagogue. Jesus finds him again. There's this big, lengthy time of questioning that happens. But for the time being, let's focus on just these first 12 verses of the chapter. And as we do that, I think what the Lord will help us see is at least three observations about the nature of suffering in the world and how Jesus approaches the issue of suffering in the world. So let me give you the first one. Here's the first observation about the nature of suffering. Suffering is real. Now that one will blow your hair back, won't it? Now you might say, of course it's real. We know it's real. We've seen it this week. We haven't just seen it on the news, we've seen it in the city. And we haven't just seen it in the city, we've seen it in our homes. We've seen it all around us. Of course, suffering is real. Anybody who's lived more than about 30 seconds knows that suffering is real. And while we know it's real intellectually, we tend to have the practice of trying to separate ourselves from it as if it's not really. Now, there's a number of ways that we might do this on a day-to-day basis. We might avoid talking too much about real human suffering. Or we might go out of our way to try and make sure that we're only sort of around it, but not really in the middle of it. Or when we do encounter it, we might try to get out of that conversation as quickly and efficiently as possible. And one of the means that we might use to try to get out of that conversation quickly and efficiently are true statements that are nevertheless unhelpful in the moment. So we might encounter real human suffering and quickly remind that person, well, you know, everything's going to work out in the end. Or remind that person, you know, she's in a better place now. All true, and yet isn't there part of us at the bottom that tends to use catch-all statements like that as a means of evacuating ourselves from having to confront the reality and all the implications of an individual situation of suffering that we encounter? Or we might do what the disciples do here, which is when they're confronted with the reality of human suffering, rather than entering into it, they use this man as a prop to have a theoretical question answered. Now keep in mind at this point everything that the disciples have seen so far in the book of John, because it's been a lot of things. They've seen Jesus turn water into wine in chapter 2. They've seen Jesus heal an official son in Capernaum in chapter 4. They've seen him heal a man that's been incapacitated for almost 40 years in chapter 5. They've seen him feed over 5,000 people, again, in chapter 5. And then, to top it all off, they've seen him walk on the Sea of Galilee. And yet, in this moment, the question that they do not ask when confronted with the reality of the human suffering is, Jesus, will you help this person? This real person? With real problems in a real situation? They don't ask that question. Instead of asking that question, they use this person as a means to try and satisfy their own curiosity. It's as if they see this man without really seeing this man. Now, we should all be familiar with that because we do things like that all the time when we see, but we don't really see. To a much lesser extent, I mean, this happens in our home all the time, and maybe it happens in your home too, with a phenomenon that I have come to just call the trash can phenomenon. Maybe you guys are familiar with this too. That it seems like sometimes the various members of our family, me included, are able to see the trash and yet not see the trash. We are able to observe a can that is completely full and yet not really see that it's completely full, as if there's some space-time continuum in the bottom of the trash can where if you just keep putting things on top of it, it will stay there so that nobody actually has to take action on this thing that is actually full and needs to be taken out. So you see it, but you don't really see it. But Jesus sees the man, unlike the disciples. He sees him. He sees him, and he refuses to treat suffering like an intellectual exercise or an uncomfortable situation to be avoided. Instead, what we see Jesus doing in response to the reality of human suffering is entering in and taking action. And if we want to follow Jesus, we have to be the kind of people who don't just treat the reality of suffering as an intellectual exercise to be dissected and microscoped like some kind of specimen in a petri dish. The second observation about suffering that we can draw from here is, first of all, suffering is real. Secondly, that suffering is complex. It's complex. If you go back to the disciples and look again at the question that they ask, because the question reveals the assumption behind the question. The question reveals the assumption that because this man is suffering, Someone must have sinned. Their question was who? Because they assumed that it was someone. So the disciples intellectually wanted a place to focus the blame for what was happening in this situation that they encountered. And that is very indicative of human nature as a whole. That when we encounter suffering, when we encounter difficulty, when trouble comes into our lives, one of the first things we want to know is, whose fault was this? It's like you have all of those things inside of you, all of that anger, all of that bitterness, all of that frustration, all of that anxiety, all of that fear, and it's swirling around deep inside of your heart, and you need a target of where to put it. Something to shoot at. That's what we want. A straight line so that we can know where do we put all of that emotion inside of ourselves. And it would be much simpler if that were the case, but suffering is not simple. It is complex. Now, in truth, there is actually a line between suffering and sin. It's just not the line that the disciples were trying to draw. The line the disciples were trying to draw was someone committed some specific act, and as a direct result of that act, this person is blind. Now, again, that's not to say that in some circumstances, the result of some direct act of sin is suffering. It's a good thing for us to keep in mind. It's a good thing for us to remember that even sins done in secret are never committed in a vacuum. That the result of the sins that we or anybody else commit always is going to have effect on someone else other than us. So sometimes when a person sins, there is a direct result of suffering on behalf of someone else. You think of a situation, for example, like a parent choosing that they do not want to stay in the home any longer, and so they leave. Now, it's also important for us to say that there is a broader link between suffering and sin, which is, again, not the link the disciples were trying to make, but a link that is nevertheless there. Because you can actually look at any situation in the world in which something has gone wrong and there is suffering, and you can say unequivocally that ultimately, at the bottom of it all, when you boil everything else away, that the reason that this thing has gone wrong or the reason that these people are suffering is because of sin. So you can trace all the suffering in the world, whether that suffering is about war or about hurricanes or about tsunamis or about sexual sin or whatever it is, you can trace it all the way back to the garden, because that's when the moment that sin became the condition in which we live. So there's a very real point here to say, yes, the reason why there is suffering as a whole is because we live in a world that has been broken by sin. And until Jesus fixes everything, there will always be moments of suffering. Again, not the line that the disciples were trying to draw. The disciples wanted something much simpler than that, much cleaner than that. A place where they could focus all the blame and all the attention. Whose fault is it? And like them, we do want that many times as well. So we should be aware of that desire in ourselves to simplify the suffering that we encounter either in our own lives or in the world. We should be aware of that desire to simplify it in order to blame someone or something. But that should also make us ask, well, if that's not the right thing to do, then what's the alternative, given the complexity of suffering? Well, perhaps we can find the alternative in another book of the Bible about another person who suffered greatly, who also wanted to find a fixed point of blame. Because really, isn't that what Job did for about 37 chapters in the book of Job? Was try to find whose fault this was, what happened, give me somewhere to focus all the pain and all the hardship and all the bitterness, give me something to focus on. And then in chapter 38, God started talking back. And when you start reading in Job chapter 38, one of the important things to recognize there is that not once did God ever answer Job's question of why this thing happened to him. He never did. He never pulled Job aside and said, well, see, there we were in heaven, and Satan came walking in. And he never gave him a glimpse into the future to show him all the Bibles that would be printed and all the number of people that would be comforted throughout history because of his own suffering and how it shows us the way to live with that suffering. He never did any of that. What God started doing in Job chapter 38 and did for the next four chapters or so was show Job himself. God didn't give Job the why he was looking for. He gave him the who he wasn't. God talked about his power, his mercy. He talked about his wisdom and his justice. He talked about all of these attributes that he possesses in abundance and the fact that human beings possess none of them. That's what Job did, that's what God did in response to Job's questions. So the alternative to looking for simplicity in the face of suffering is to look to the who. It's to realize that in the midst of complexity, that there is a God waiting for us, not only at the end of suffering, but actually in the midst of it. And that leads us to the third observation about suffering in the world, and that is that suffering is a window. So suffering is real, suffering is complex, and suffering is a window. Now think about that image with me for just a second. What does a window do? Well, a window is something you look through in order to see something that is on the other side of it. And that's what Jesus says as he redirects the disciples' question. The disciples want to know, whose fault is this? Is it this man or is it his parents? And Jesus says, neither one of them, that the reason that this man was born blind was so that the works of God could be seen through him. In other words, this man is a window. His suffering is a window through which we can see the works of God. You could also say it that Jesus wanted the disciples to know, and maybe even the man himself to know, that this suffering, though it's incredibly real and though it's incredibly complex, is also not for nothing. That there's actually purpose here, and specifically the purpose here is to be a revelation of the works of God. Now, how in the world does that work? How in the world can suffering serve as a window through which we can see the work of God? Well, the most basic way that we see suffering being a window for the works of God is through the power of God. And we certainly see that in this passage. I mean, Jesus tells this man to go wash in the pool of Siloam, and he does, and he can see again, and the power of God is displayed. And sometimes that's exactly how it works for us in the midst of suffering, that the people of God pray about a situation, and God chooses to exercise his power in that situation, and we stand back in awe and wonder at the power and the mercy of God, who can do whatever it is that he wants to do at whatever time that he wants to do it. So the work of God is displayed through that, but that's not the only way that the work of God can be displayed through the window of suffering. It might also be displayed through testimony. And we also see this happening here. An occasion of suffering uniquely provides an opportunity for such a testimony, because when the Christian is able to stand underneath the weight of suffering, the very natural question that comes from the outside looking in is, what has happened to you? When people ask that question, they don't typically mean it about the suffering in itself. What they mean is, what has happened to you that you can be the way you are now, even in the midst of suffering? It's the same question that gets asked to the man, because there has been such an incredible change that's happened to him. What has happened to you? You start thinking about that question and you start to see how remarkably similar it is to the question that the crowd asked at Pentecost to the random Galileans who were suddenly speaking in different languages to them. What is happening here? Aren't these unschooled Galileans? And it's really similar to the question that people asked when they encountered the boldness of Peter and John. And then they could only remark that surely these men had been with Jesus. It's probably really similar to a lot of the questions that people asked of Paul after he had his encounter with Jesus on the Damascus Road. When you encounter Jesus, especially in the midst of suffering, the change was dramatic and so still is. No one who encounters Jesus in a real way remains the same. And so this man, who doesn't have all the theological terms right, and this man, who doesn't know all the ins and outs of what's happened to him, this man, who doesn't even really, at this point, know fully who Jesus is, and he certainly doesn't understand the medical implications of what has happened, this man only knows this: I trusted Jesus enough to do what he told me to do. And now I can see. And isn't that really what the gospel is all about? That Jesus, the light of the world, still extends the call to come to him and to repent and believe over and over again. And when we do that, we move from darkness to light. We move from being spiritually blind to being able to spiritually see, and the change is significant in us as well. And so what do we say in response to the questions when people ask, what happened to you? When you take everything else away, the essence of the answer is still the same. I trusted Jesus enough to do what he told me to do, and now I can see. And then, of course, there's one other way that the works of God are displayed through the window of suffering. That sometimes it's not just through the power of God, and sometimes it's not just through the testimony of the people of God. Sometimes the works of God are displayed through the window of suffering through what happens in us. Because something deep happens in us when we walk with Jesus through a period of suffering. We see Jesus in a much clearer way than we ever have before. Because suffering has a way of sharpening our vision, of clarifying what really matters, of letting us know what is absolutely sustaining, of deepening our faith, of refining our hope. There is a measure of hope, maturity, wisdom, and intimacy with Jesus that only comes through the experience of suffering and difficulty. And we see this happening with the man as well. Did you notice that when the people first came to him and said, what happened to you? How he referred to Jesus, he said, the man called Jesus told me to go and wash. Well, if you fast forward a few verses, you're going to get another inquest, another inquisition, where the Pharisees are going to ask similar questions. What happened to you? But all of a sudden, the man's answer has changed. Now, he doesn't just refer to Jesus as a man. He says, Jesus, the prophet. And then the Pharisees are going to excommunicate the man from the synagogue, and Jesus himself is going to come and find him again, and Jesus is going to start questioning him, and the man is going to look to Jesus and call him Lord and fall down in worship. So in the span of about an hour or two, you get a person going from seeing Jesus as a random man to Jesus being a prophet to Jesus being the Lord. And this is what happens when we walk with Jesus through pain and difficulty. It is that you come to see him and know him in a more clear way than you ever have before. And one of the most wonderful pieces of news about that is that you will never, ever be disappointed when you get closer to Jesus. He is unique in the entire universe in this respect, because everyone else that you respect, everyone else that you admire, everyone else that you put on a pedestal, everyone else, the closer you get to that person, the more clearly you can see all of their flaws, all of their shortcomings, all of their fears, all of their insecurities. It's as if the closer you get to the people that you hold in high esteem, they start to shrink in stature. But not Jesus. Jesus is the only one who actually gets bigger the closer you get. Friends, this morning as we think about suffering, not just in the world, but also in our own lives in various contexts and in various ways, I pray that the Lord would help us, that he would help us to not be afraid to admit that suffering is real and not be content to oversimplify what's happening, and then at the end of it to understand that suffering really is a window to see the works of God displayed in our lives and in the world.